Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, where Charles Edel makes a welcome first appearance at the Sydney Institute. His presence in Sydney was drawn to our attention by our good friend Bruce Wolpe. Now, our speaker is a senior fellow at the United States Study Centre at the University of Sydney and previously served on the US Secretary of State's policy planning staff. He was also an associate professor at the US Naval War College, and his most recent book before this book is a book on John Quincy Adams and the Grand Strategy of the Republic. But Charles Edel is in town around the time of the publication of his book with Hal Brands called The Lessons of Tragedy, Statecraft and the World Order. And so the topic for tonight's talk is statecraft and the world order. You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the invitation, Jared and Anne. Thank you, all of you, for braving it out tonight. And I should tell you, what you just heard is a lie. I'm not just in town for now. We're here temporarily. We're temporary transplants to Sydney for 3 years. Sadly, we're more than halfway through those 3 years. This is just the time to have a little bit of perspective from the fevered swamp that is Washington, D.C. And that's a decent starting point, because I'd like to say that the point of this talk tonight is to scare the hell out of you. I'm kidding. Kind of. Now, as the title of the book indicates, The Lessons of Tragedy, this is a book about the role that tragedy plays in international affairs. And its basic argument is that tragedy is more normal than we think, and that we're closer to one today than we often realize. But we're getting ahead of ourselves, because we don't want to start here and with today, but rather go back to some ancient history. And in fact, the book starts not with today, but with the birthplace of tragedy in ancient Athens in the 5th century BC. Now, if you can cast your minds back to university or secondary school when you learned about this period, or maybe didn't ever learn about this period, what you will note was this is when Athens was at the height of its power. It had a navy that ruled the seas. It had an empire that straddled much of the known world. It had a relatively liberal and open democratic system that was the pride of its citizens and one that we still marvel at today. And yet, the Athenians were obsessed with tragedy. Every year, they would gather to watch plays. They would watch them, these dramatic plays presented to the entire community and which were financed by the public treasury. And when you went to watch these plays, you would watch prominent individuals fall from great heights due to errors, due to ignorance, and due to hubris. And they did this because they understood that it was essential to think about tragedy constantly if you would hope to actually avoid it in real life. That is, by staring tragedy straight in the face, by understanding how quickly things could spiral out of control, they hoped to instill in their entire community a sense of resolve and purpose to take the actions that they wouldn't otherwise take to avoid tragedies. Now, we think that's a pretty good way of understanding tragedy and its role in international affairs. It's just not a particularly American way of understanding international affairs. Now, for most Americans, and I probably would lump Australians in here too, and you can tell me if I'm wrong later, they tend to think that history is a series of progress towards a more prosperous and more just world. Now, 30 years on from the end of the Cold War, the idea that a true buckling of the international system could return is almost unthinkable. But this perspective is deeply ahistorical, because catastrophic collapses of the international order, replete with great power war, human suffering unfolding on a giant scale, are more the norm than they are the exception in human history. And in fact, most of history has been punctured by repeated upendings of the international order. Now, we don't have to go too far to think about this, because it happened to the Greeks themselves, notwithstanding their obsession with tragedy. If you think about the Great Peloponnesian War, it happened in Europe during the 30 Years' War, during the wars both before and after the Napoleonic upheavals. It happened, of course, in Europe during World War I, and then it happened on a global scale on World War II. Each of these upheavals were preceded by intensifying challenges to the international order, and then rapid breakdowns of that order. And in each, the scale of violence was unimaginable to observers who were there right beforehand. Now, that's the really bad news. But there's also some good news here, because for those that experienced tragedies, tragedy can serve as a source of inspiration. These breakdowns were so traumatic, they were so awful, that modern international orders often took place, the construction of international norms and institutions, the configurations of international power, in the direct aftermath of those orders, because people wanted to make sure that they could do anything possible to avoid a recurrence. Now, I am not making the argument, and I don't want you to mistake it, that simply thinking about tragedy is enough to stave it off. It also often depended on a favorable configuration of power and a relative cohesion ideologically between the most powerful states. But it was oftentimes the experience and the knowledge of those tragedies and the hope to avoid and forestall another one that drove those powers to create the orders in the first place. Now think, for instance, of the Treaty of Westphalia, the Peace of Westphalia that came after the 30 Years' War. Now this was a diplomatic revolution. It enshrined an entirely new international order that was predicated on national sovereignty, secular and not religious authority, and a relative balance of power on the European continent. And it ended up producing relative great power peace for more than 100 years, because the victors, because those who had come together at Westphalia, having experienced 30 years of war, wanted to do just about anything to prevent it. Or think about, for instance, the Concert of Europe that comes on the heels of the Napoleonic upheavals. The Concert of Europe was anchored by Russian and British power and a relatively conservative order that prevailed in the capitals of Europe at that time. But it also figured regular diplomatic consultations between those powers and agreements to do things such as not to reorder the territorial status by force. And it's because, as much as they were forward-looking, and of course you had 100 years of peace after that, it was also rooted in a backwards-looking sensibility, that they didn't want to repeat what they had just gone through for 25 straight years. Now, the post-1945 order, led by the United States, was rooted in a similar familiarity with tragedy. Now, today, we oftentimes look back at 1945 and we think that there's a bright, shining line between those horrible events of the first half of the 20th century and all the progress that we saw in the second half of the 20th century. But that is an ahistorical way of thinking about that, because the statesmen who had lived through World War II itself thought that we were headed for another crack-up of the international system with nuclear weapons, a World War III. They thought it was inevitable. Now, in fact, it was not inevitable, of course, but that was because of the efforts that America took with its allies, and it was rooted in their understanding of what they had just lived through. After the Great Depression and World War II, American leaders consciously rejected the isolationist attitudes that had prevailed during the 1920s and 30s. they concluded that it was the failure to stand up for friendly nations facing coercive pressure, the failure to push back against protectionism and trade wars, the failure to stand up for democracy and democratic values that had created chaos and was an invitation to revisionist powers to push the envelope. And if we think about the failures, the lessons of those failures that they drew, this informed the great efforts and successes of the post-war order, a relatively open economic order, a security system based on a network of alliances that was supposed to suppress revisionism and create stability, the advance of democracy and prosperity throughout the world. Now, what we normally think of as a consciously concocted order was less rooted in that than it was a retrospective gaze and a hope to avoid what they had just come through. And the point here was that the logic was essentially preventative, that it was better and it was cheaper to pay costs now than to have to pay massive costs after the order had collapsed, that it was better to make modest sacrifices now before you had to pay enormous sacrifices later, and that safeguarding the norms and institutions required continual support and maintenance. The trouble with success, however, is that it breeds complacency. And the post-war order has been so successful that Americans and many American allies now seem to be losing the tragic sensibility that brought it about in the first place. It's been 75 years since World War II. It's been more than 30 years since the end of the Cold War. And it's brought to the fore this idea that great power competition, in fact, great power war, is an impossibility. And yet, because of that thinking that it's an impossibility, it's resulted in a slackening of some of the efforts required to stave it off. Now, it's been said that Americans are serial amnesiacs, and this amnesia has clearly been on display in recent years. Now, in 2013, 52% of Americans said that they thought that America should mind its own business and leave the rest of the world to get along as best as it could. By 2016, that number had gone up to 57%. Now, I can quote lots of polls that say just the other thing, right? That Americans actually, they're thinking and the value that they place on alliances, free trade, and democracy has gone up. But if you simply look at the leaders that Americans have chosen in recent years, I think it's a pretty easy argument to make that Americans are no longer so eager to bear the costs and the burdens traditionally associated with leadership. Now, if you think about every election since the end of the Cold War, in every election, by my count, except for one, Americans chose the presidential candidate who promised to do less rather than more in the world. And if you think of even the last two American presidents, Barack Obama and Donald Trump, in very different ways, have expressed skepticism for this American project of leading the international order. Now, Donald Trump has simply just taken this to another level. There is no amount of tragic sensibility in how he thinks about the world. There's no understanding that the world has avoided collapse precisely because the efforts that America has taken along with its allies over the past 70 years. Now, in fact, if Americans have gotten tired of bearing the costs of global leadership, I would say that's probably because they've simply forgotten why that leadership matters, why it's worth bearing, and what it's meant to forestall in the first place. These are some honest questions that have come to the fore in American political discourse, even if they're asked in really rude ways. Because why is it that America has a series of alliances all over the world? That's an honest question. Why is it that American men and women in uniform, no less military hardware, is projected forward into the world? Why is it that Americans should care about faraway places like Ukraine and the South China Sea? Why is it that Americans should leave their markets open at the short term, sometimes at the medium, and sometimes even at the long-term cost to American workers and industries? Now, there are answers to those questions, and they generally are historical in nature. that without America playing this role, we can look at the very nasty things that tended to happen in the beginning of the 20th century. But most of the country seems determined to forget this history because the favorable conditions of American leadership have made it possible for them to forget. The irony, I would add, is that this amnesia seems to be setting in just as the international environment is becoming more fraught. You now have all three key regions of Eurasia, the Middle East, Europe, and Asia, experiencing upheaval simultaneously. You have a broader array of threats and challenges than we've confronted in the past. The democratic wave has already crested, and now we see a push by authoritarians. You can see nibbling at the periphery of American power, contesting of America's credibility. And you can even see this, if we get a little more practical, by Chinese leaders working to create a Sino-centric Asia, if not a Sino-centric global order. You can hear this when Vladimir Putin talks about the transition to a post-Western order. And I would just say it's hard to imagine how either of these transitions occur without great levels of violence, intimidation, and coercion. Now, if I've painted a bleak picture for you, the point is that you can begin to see the warning lights flashing on the dashboard. There are indications that the international system, which has been historically exceptional in its stability and the consent that it's generated, is coming under stress. I would add that the revival of great power competition is particularly troubling because it's generally accompanied by full-scale war. And at the same time, we see the defenders of this order, those democratic societies for the most part that have the most to gain, that have benefited the most, confused, distracted, or caught in neutral at best. That's a very bad combination, historically speaking. And if we don't see a change, I would argue that we might even look back at the period now as a moment before greater upheavals to come. So, how do we get ahead of the curve here? This is not simply meant to depress you. It's meant to prompt a question of what it is that we need to do about it. And I would say that the key to answering this has more to do with principles than it does with specific actions. This is not a book that has a 14-set prescription plan for how you remedy this. I think there are useful debates to be had, and maybe we'll have some of them during Q&A, about specific policy recommendations, how much the U.S. should spend on its military budget, how do you push back against economic protectionism, what do you do against creeping Chinese expansionism in the South China Sea, how do you make sure that Russia doesn't interfere in democratic systems. Now, those are healthy debates to have, but I would argue that healthy thought has to precede healthy policy prescription. And so where we really end the book, and what I would like to spend a little time doing, is talking about recovering a tragic sensibility that should prompt and inform that debate. So a couple of principles that I think would aid in that. First, a recognition that tragedy is normal, that international orders are more fragile than even the sharpest commentators who live during them realize, and that when they break down, the results are often more catastrophic than they can possibly imagine. Now, gaze back at the history that I've sketched for you. In 1792, William Pitt, who is the Prime Minister of Great Britain, predicts that Great Britain has about 20 years ahead of it with a very favorable geopolitical environment at which it can expand the empire. That's right before it descends in 25 years of warfare with France. In 1910, Norman Angell makes a name for himself for all time as the worst prognosticator of international events by saying that it would be inconceivable that the great powers would go to war considering how intertwined their economies are. 1910, that was. In the 1920s and the 1930s, very few of the commentators who were observing international events, who had already lived through World War I, would have predicted what was coming just a couple of years later. And that all is to say that individuals in almost every era and every age oftentimes think the foundations of cooperation, coordination, peace, and stability are becoming more solid just as the sand begins to shift under their feet. Now, it's tempting for us all to think that way and to believe that our society, because we're more enlightened than they were, is immune to such tendencies. But to think that way is to fall into this very same ahistorical mode of thinking that generally precedes the fall. Yes, the order that we have is very stable. The fact that it's lasted as long as it has suggests that. But to think that it is immune to challenge, erosion, and upheaval is to fall into the very same trap that the Greeks would warn us about. That when you begin thinking that tragedy is impossible, that is actually and ironically when it becomes more possible. Second principle, to note that tragedy is once again stalking international events. Today, Russia and China already see themselves as locked into a great power competition with the United States, and they're using force and other forms of coercion to chip away at some of those norms that we have all come to respect, such as freedom of navigation and non-aggression and non-territorial expansion. Meanwhile, I've already noted this, the countries with the most to lose from this seem to be divided, seem to be confused, seem to be looking to others to take up the mantle for them. What's clear is that the telltale signs of erosion are there for all of us to see. Now, the first step towards recovery is admitting that you have a problem. And having a tragic sensibility requires understanding the world for what it is, especially when the outlook is looking more ominous. Third point. Just because the international order is under strain does not mean that it is bound to collapse. A third aspect of tragic sensibility is understanding that we need to reject complacency without falling into the trap of fatalism, that there's nothing that we can do about this. Now, simply look at the statistics. In 2016, America still occupied about 20% of world GDP. That's actually not far off the norm, or I should say the high, that America possessed in 1970. When you begin to add in democratic allies and partners from around the world, we're talking roughly 60% of global GDP and military outlays, far greater than any competitor here. Now, another way to think about this might be by analogizing. If you were someone who was meant to topple, was intending to topple the international order, whose hand would you rather have? Would you rather have China's hand? A rising power for sure with a lot of national strength, but one that's also ringed by historical rivals, that is beset by long-term demographic challenges, and that it is susceptible to an increasingly authoritarian regime. Would you rather have the hand of Russia, whose bold moves on the international stage seem to mask what is long-term national decline and a third-rate economy? You can think about this in another way. You can compare it temporally. Would we rather be in the situation that we found ourselves in the early Cold War, where there were Soviet tanks stationed in the heart of Europe and there were power vacuums throughout the world? Would we rather be in the situation that we found ourselves in coming out of Vietnam in the mid-1970s, when the Soviets were reaching for military primacy, when there were less than 40 democracies in the world, and when capitalism itself looked like it was bound to collapse? Now, to ask those questions, I think, is to prompt the answer that I want you to reach on those. But I would say in 1947, Chip Bolin, who was a senior U.S. State Department official, observed that the emerging Cold War meant that the free world could still hold its own if it closed ranks. The dream of a seamless global order might be over for the time being because of the Soviet Union. But the defenders of that order had the strength and the resources capable of defending not only where they were, but potentially even gradually expanding that zone, as long as they had the resolve, the cohesion, and the wisdom to use that strength effectively. Now, that's a pretty good description of where they were in 1947. It's also, I think, a pretty good description of where we find ourselves today. And that brings me to the point that preserving a free and open international order can't be done on the cheap, nor can it be done as a solitary effort. A fourth facet of this tragic sensibility, which I think the Greeks would prompt us into, is an understanding of the need for collective action and communal sacrifice. Now, in the 1990s, America seemed to have military superiority, and the forces of globalization seemed that they would probably tame our previous rivals. That was a decent bet to place at the time. It's not how things have worked out, however. So if that moment, the post-Cold War moment, is indisputably over, there are a couple of things that we need to shed along with it. And the first is for Americans. And that I think Americans need to understand that the world is likely to only be as congenial as they are willing to make it. And that if they decline to pay the costs and make the sacrifices involved in shaping the world, they also have to forego some of the benefits. Now, what's true for America is equally true for the broader coalition of like-minded states. In geopolitics, as in many things, there's great strength in numbers. But that's only true if democratic allies lock arms and commit to this together. Now, there are important implications here for both the United States and its allies. For friends of the United States who have a vested stake in preserving that relatively free and open international order, there is much that can and should be done. The more that European and Asian powers can do to defend themselves, to provide institutions and mechanisms that create and stabilize an open order, the more likely they are to provide their own security, and frankly, the more likely they are to convince Americans that the cost that America pays is worth it. They're more likely to shape succeeding administrations in Washington that it should pay more if they pay more. And simultaneously, if the United States does not choose to play that role, it puts them in a better position to defend themselves. Now, fifth point here, that it's incumbent to take timely and enduring action. Now, if you remember anything from reading those Greek tragedies, you probably remember the storm clouds that were gathering over the protagonists' heads. You could see it even if they couldn't, right? You could see what was coming, and that you knew that only if they took action could they possibly wrench things off the course. And of course they never did, and of course that's why the outcomes they had with which they did. Now, this is actually an important lesson today, because the international order is being tested, right? Not only the norms and institutions and the relative balance of power, but when we begin to see challenges for freedom of navigation in the South China Sea, challenges against democratic societies by Russia, challenges against the use of things like chemical weapons against non-combatants, international orders are only as strong as it is that we choose to defend them. So when you choose not to defend them, the international order shifts. And that was as true in the 1930s in Abyssinia and Manchuria as it is today in Ukraine and the South China Sea. Next point, and I'm getting to the end here, so don't worry. Next point, if you remember one other thing about Greek tragedy, you'll remember that word, hubris, right? Balance. Now, this sense of action and taking action needs to be tempered with a healthy sense of restraint and balance. For the Greeks, hubris was no less a sin than complacency, and excessive ambition was as dangerous as was insufficient courage. Now, this is not a theoretical point. It's one that's borne out by America's historical experiences. The U.S. intervention in Vietnam not only did not accomplish the objectives that it set out to, but it ushered in a period of doubt amongst Americans as the international environment grew much more fraught in the late 1970s. If we're talking about the crisis of American internationalism today, we have to begin with a conversation about Iraq as well. Now, I do think that there's a healthy debate that can be had on both the initial wisdom and the ultimate winnability of both of those wars. But the point is when the American public feels that their leaders have overreached or stumbled into a quagmire, they are less likely to take actions to keep them safe, even when those actions become more necessary because of the international environment. The bad news here is there's no precise formula for how you calculate this. There's no precise formula for how do you weigh action against inaction. And in fact, what we would call for is simply an awareness that tragedy lurks on both extremes. And if you are conscious of it, you might be marginally more skilled at steering yourself between the poles. Final point here. So how do Americans, frankly, how do Australians, recover the sense of tragic sensibility before it's too late? Another way of asking this is, how do you get democratic societies to act before it's too late? Well, in ancient Athens, the Athenians used tragedy. And if you think about tragedy, they were kind of strange. They were mythological plays that made oblique references to the present to try to prompt communal action. We don't have to do that, right? We have a very real past that is so instructive because it is so real. Now, this is not a call for cramming all of American society into theater benches and for getting them all to watch plays. But without a similar determination to recover a history that now Americans seem determined to forget, I think that we're losing something essential. In writing about the long interval of peace that followed the Congress of Vienna in the 19th and early 20th century, Henry Kissinger once wrote that in that long interval of peace, a sense of the tragic was forgotten. It was forgotten that states could die and that upheavals could be irretrievable. Now, one suspects that we'll soon end up relearning these lessons of tragedy, either by reacquainting ourselves with them as a mode to propel and prompt ourselves to take actions we otherwise would not, or by experiencing them. So at this point, let me open it up to all of you and see where you want to go on the conversation.
Many thanks. As I said at the start, we've got copies of The Lessons of Tragedy, Statecraft, and The World Order, and I'm sure our speaker will be happy to sign some after the talk concludes. So now we come to questions and discussion. You're speaking a lot about tragedy in the sense, as you know, the United States gets involved with the world again after a tragedy. For example, Roosevelt in the Second World War went to the 1940 election promising no American boy would die in Europe, and then within 1 year or 2 years, the United States is involved in the Second World War, both in the Pacific and in Europe. But if you look at around right now, you've got, as you said, President Obama, President Trump haven't been all that interested in projecting U.S. power. But then President Trump's got a reasonable point when he says to Angela Merkel that there's no one much in Europe wanting to do it either, apart from the British and the French to some extent, but not the Germans much. So how do you bring about a sense of tragedy without a tragedy?
Well, isn't that the million-dollar question? Because, look, oftentimes history doesn't have a particularly good set of precedents for us. What mobilizes and spurs democratic societies who always have different ways that they want to spend their precious resources? What really motivates them? Well, it's generally something going boom in a really big way. That is a horrible outcome and one that all of us should really want to avoid. So the question is, can we get ahead of that? Now, the Soviets were very helpful here in 1947, 48, 49, 50, 51, 52 by making the threat so clear. Today, it's a little bit more nebulous because it comes from so many different sources. But I do think, frankly, you're talking to a historian who has policy wayward tendencies, that I would say the best answer I can give you from my own perspective is more history. Right? That's how you do civic education. Well, we're not talking about great mass staging of plays. You put this history in front of people. But look, I can write all the books that I want, and it's really not going to make that a hoot of a difference. It has to be informed by political leadership, fundamentally. And so I would say that a broader way of taking on your question, Jared, is American internationalism, I don't know if it's the same here, you can tell me if it is, has always been informed by, propped up by, a three-legged stool. Fear of what would happen without it. When Harry Truman makes the pitch to spend enormous amounts of resources, which he says are really small amounts of resources considering what America had just gone through in World War II, it is by looking back to what had just gone and making sure that that wouldn't come. But fear alone isn't enough. It has to be predicated on hope that there is a better alternative out there. And that's what the international order was premised on. But fear and hope can't be done without political leadership. Now, I would say as I survey the entire post-war field of American foreign policy, every single U.S. president, no matter what their disposition was coming into office, understood that making this argument to Americans that they should pay more than they otherwise would in peacetime, that their sons and daughters had to be on the front lines, this was never as easy an argument as we thought it was, as we now think it is. But they also understood that at the senior level, that if they did not make that argument, some of the natural impulses and tendencies of the American people would necessarily pull you. So the president in the American system always acted as the calcium in the backbone of American internationalism. And so that's why, in many ways, this present moment strikes me as such a troubling one, because now you actually have a president who is making the opposite argument of that.
Question. Thank you for your remarks and for your book, which I've enjoyed reading. Two quick questions. This proposition for you to address. There are only two threats to the international order, both related to territorial integrity, namely state-sponsored territorial expansion and large uncontrollable movements of population. And the second proposition is this. Are your final points your equivalent of George F. Kennan's 1946 long telegram? And if not, what else would you add?
Okay, so I hope you all have about 3.5 hours for me to dive into proposition number one before we get to proposition number two. So I would add to, actually, your list that the two most important and destabilizing factors in world politics are not only state-sponsored territorial aggression and large flows of refugees, which have destabilized Western politics. I actually think you have to add a kind of technological innovation, which we're only on the cusp of understanding what it does. Because, look, Twitter is great. It's actually not great. It's the worst thing in the world, as with Facebook, as with all these things. But in one sense, it's very empowering, right? These are very empowering technologies because they allow the average citizen to communicate in ways that they never have with their leaders. But they also allow leaders to reach into democratic societies, disrupt them, amplify the tensions that are pre-existent within them. And this is only going to get worse based on what we see the technologies looking like. Open societies are vulnerable to this. There will be, I think, there has to be a rethink of what this means in a present age that is undergirded. I think the fundamental driver today is not the two things that you mentioned, but the return of great power competition. And that's going to inform laws, politics, and regulations. And let me flip on that for one more point, that when I was going around the U.S. Kind of talking about this book, I ended the tour in Austin. I was giving a talk at University of Texas at Austin. Now, while I was there, the big, very cool, very hip festival, South by Southwest, was also going on. I am not cool enough to be invited there. That's why I was at the university. But I did go and have a bunch of drinks with friends who were there. And I said, look, I am flipping through the program here. And I get a sense So South by Southwest is a cultural spectacle, but it's also really one predicated on technology. I am getting a sense that over the past 2 years, this entire conversation has shifted very rapidly from utopian futures to dystopian futures that technology can enable, right? Technology is neutral, but it's going to become much more hard and much more fraught. So I would add that one. Now, very briefly, is this George Kennan? Kennan only gets it half right. So George Kennan, who is the first director of policy planning at the State Department, who writes the Long Telegraph, who authors the policy of containment, by the way, and then says, you misinterpreted what I said in that, and spends the rest of his career, which is about 60 years extra, trying to correct what containment is. You have to pair Kennan, who's the first director and conceptualizer of this, with Paul Nitze, the second director, who authors NSC 68, which is a much more robust look about what containment might look like. One is not right, the other is not wrong. But it's a pairing of the two of them that begins to highlight and underscore actually what a competitive mindset might actually mean.
There's a question here.
I just wanted to follow on from the last question. You've talked extensively about the role of states in international order and the use of states, and you mentioned Twitter and states using that. I was wondering if you care to comment on, say, for example, long-term environmental changes as in the same area. Is it all about states, or are there external threats beyond the state system that could threaten international order as well?
So yes. Yes. Full stop. I just don't have a wonderful way to package this and have you think about it. So on the one hand, I would say, look, what we spent most of the last 20 years thinking about were non-state actors, terrorist groups, not climate change, although that was building. But that has now shifted in terms of the prioritization of threats. Now, I was giving a talk about a week ago down in Melbourne about how to think about whether or not we're in a new Cold War. Does that analogy actually hold or not? And if you think that way, does it make us miss certain things? And a gentleman stood up and asked me, he said, well, aren't you missing the biggest thing? Aren't you missing climate change? And shouldn't we be focused on that as opposed to all this other stuff? Because can't we work with some of these revisionist powers? And I would say two things to that about how I try to think about this. One is this call for a collective section and a collective sacrifice, communal resolve, can be equally applied to something like that. And I think actually it should be. Second point, ignoring the bad stuff to focus on the long-term drivers of where we see cooperation only gets it half right. Because when we begin to think about where, say, the U.S. and China have cooperated on areas around climate change during the Obama administration, it's my read of this that it wasn't because the United States and China wanted to do the exact same thing and because they thought it would help each other. It's because they both thought it was in their own interests. But that does not mean that one side isn't competing with the other and trying to undermine the other. So the answer, I think, is yes, but, yes, and.
You mentioned quite rightly that hubris was endemic in the Greek attitude towards tragedy. And indeed, Aristotle mentions that when he speaks of Oedipus Rex as being the greatest example of tragedy, because Oedipus had a good man who got hubristic. Now, you also mentioned in your talk that the West, and particularly the United States, is guilty of complacency. Could you just give us your views on the relationship between complacency and hubris and apply that to the United States?
Yes, I think oftentimes the United States is hubristic, and that's part and parcel of having a leadership role. The question is, can you avoid the big traps as you do so? Second point, being complacent. I think the overwhelming impetus for this book is that I think that the United States and leadership within the United States tends to not learn the lessons of the past. They tend to overlearn them, right? So if it was Barack Obama's proposition that George W. Bush did way too much, involved itself in too many places, committed too many resources, particularly in the Middle East, particularly against terrorism, he would do less. Now, that actually made a fair amount of sense until it didn't. Now, if it's Donald Trump's proposition that Obama was still doing too much and he was going to do way less. So I think, again, I don't have an answer for this one because there's not a formula. But I think it's noting that American public opinion and therefore American foreign policy tends to oscillate between extremes, doing too much and doing too little as a corrective or indeed an overcorrective. So I think the point of talking about this regularly is to say, can we temper some of those wild swings? That's not a good enough answer, but it's the place where the conversation needs to start.
There's a question here.
Yes, I was just wondering about your reference to winning in the Middle East. How do you define winning, like in Iraq and Afghanistan? I mean, I think that's a really important issue for countries like Australia and Afghanistan. Australia and the US, when we're sending our own citizens over there and putting them in harm's way.
So I think part of this, and maybe this has to riff off a little bit of our last question about hubris, is tempering expectations of what can realistically be accomplished. And simultaneously understanding that trying to solve certain problems might in fact be not quite worth it with the expenditure of resources that are required or the unintended effects that it might produce. Now you're talking about Afghanistan and Iraq and Australia's involvement there, but I'm also thinking about North Korea. And that some of the efforts cannot be won. Right, they can only be managed. I was having a conversation with some young Australian soldiers about this who said, isn't it a tragedy that now we're beginning to see young men and women deploy to Afghanistan who weren't even born on 9/11? And I said, no, it's not. The policy choices in Afghanistan might have been erroneous. We should critique those. That's what you do in a democratic society. But first of all, it's not the type of tragedy that I'm talking about here, a full buckling of the international order. And second of all, committing resources, even committing them for a very long time, an unending amount of time, that's the unpopular thing to say. We think about American placement of soldiers in Germany, still, in Japan, still, on the DMZ in Korea, still. That's not a tragedy in and of itself. So effort, pushing this forward, is part, in some ways, of the entire order-building project.
There's an old saying, my enemy's enemy is my friend. And the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan back in 79,
right,
and the West backed the Taliban. The Soviet Union left 10 years later, and the Taliban came back to bite us. In the Iran-Iraq War from 80 to 88, the West backed Saddam Hussein. Now, 9/11 came about, and quite rightly, the United States went after the people. What I cannot understand is why Iraq suddenly figured when it had nothing to do with the with 9/11 attacks. Was that policy gone awry?
So, again, we don't have 3.5 hours to relitigate the decisions of the George W. Bush administration. Is it policy gone awry? Yes. That's my personal opinion. However, I would say two things about it in broad stroke, and then we can have a longer conversation about this on the side, maybe afterwards. On the one hand, the logic of the George W. Bush administration, even if it wasn't the public logic that they were talking about, made sense. You don't have to agree with it, but it made sense. It was demonstration effect. That's what they were trying to do. The links were very tenuous. The intelligence did not hold up, but was trying to create a model of what a stable, prosperous, democratic society in the Middle East could look like. Point one, the logic actually makes sense. Whether or not you could pull it off, whether or not it was an overly ambitious objective, whether or not hubris began to cloud not only the conception of the end state, but also the undercommitment of resources towards that, point two.
There's a question here. And we're getting to the end. People, People have got to be brief.
That I think is intended
towards
me. No, you're
fine. No, it's not. No, I know my questioners, yes. Yes.
There's three things that I think might be playing into
it. We've got to be brief.
One of them is America's unpreparedness with 5G compared to China. The second one is the hypersonic missiles, which have been developed by Russia and China, and America is fighting to get a position there. And finally, the battle format of the American army is still very much in the 50s and 60s, rather than becoming the mobile groups that they are today around the world.
So I would agree with you on the first two. I would probably take issue with you on the third, that I think that the U.S. has updated its doctrine. I will say this is meant to be a nonpartisan book, but no one's objective, of course. And look, we come in for a fair amount of, Trump comes in for a fair amount of criticism, but it's only for three paragraphs, because that's about as much criticism or space as we think that he deserves. However, I did say in the talk that I think that some of the actions that they are taking, even if in the most ugly fashion possible, are the appropriate reactions. And the one thing, now it's always very dangerous to talk about the Trump administration, because it's very hard to understand the Trump administration, because are we talking about the Trump administration or are we talking about President Trump? Because oftentimes they seem to work at cross purposes. But if we're talking about the Trump administration, the transition to a more competitive mindset, as outlined by the formal documents of the United States of America in its national security strategy of 2017, its national defense strategy, at least the 10 pages that were unclassified that came out in January of 2018, begin to align American thinking and therefore procurement and therefore resources around this. One. Two, does this alert us to the fact that we have not been investing appropriately enough into the future space of where the economies are likely to grow and where those have flow-on effects? Absolutely. That's why you were seeing this debate about Huawei jump up all over the place. It jumped up yet again today, where it turned out that, by the way, there is a backdoor into Huawei, as we've now found out in Italy. But the question is not only critiquing, but what are the allied democratic states doing to invest in R&D, to propel themselves forward, and to commit a sufficient amount of national resources to make sure that they can retain a competitive edge. The one thing I'd add here is that there's a great little speech that the senior director of Asia policy on the National Security Council gave at the Chinese embassy in Washington, D.C. in Chinese. And he said, I want to make sure that we get this right. I'm going to quote Confucius for you because words matter a lot. I won't give you my really mangled Chinese when I do this. But he said that it's important to recognize that competition is not a four-letter word. In fact, democratic societies are based on competition, are based on contestability. But we've forgotten that. And now that we are in a different type of geopolitical environment, we need to rethink the allocation of resources, both within our societies, amongst allies as well, for where and which areas we have to prioritize for competition. I think you've signaled two of them.
Question here.
If you look back at the 30s and the 40s, coming up to the Second World War, it seems to me that it was the tragedy of the First World War that brought about half a decade or more of appeasement of dictators. To my mind, looking at Donald Trump, he seems to be much more in that appeasement model, rather than, and that is because everyone is terrified of North Korea. And with Obama, he was in the appeasement model with Iran. So how much is it that it isn't so much tragedy, but we're scared, and the idea that we'll something worse could happen, we can talk our way through it instead.
Absolutely, Anne. So let me make two points, broad points here. One, I made the argument that is being scarred from real tragedies that propels people to take actions as individuals, as communities, as nations, and as alliances they wouldn't otherwise take to create stability. But you have the counter argument of what happened in the interwar years after World War I. Because as you've just laid out, people were so scarred by what happened that the thought was you can never allow this to happen again, and so therefore arms races are really bad and we won't compete in them. And in fact, that might be true if it's a stable geopolitical environment. but tends to be less true when it's in unstable geopolitical environment where you have revisionist powers arming themselves. In fact, if you want a more fully formed answer, it's all there for you in chapter 3.
Just one final question, because you've now been here halfway through your term, 18 months, as you said, another 18 months ago, and you've made various comments about the administration, well, the president and the president's administration, which you distinguish a little bit. But from an Australian perspective, it seems to me that the Australian government, and I don't think there's much difference with the Australian opposition at the moment, the Australian government seems to have quite a good relationship with President Trump and the Trump administration. I think it's fair to say that we seem to think that the attitude they've taken to China is appropriate. I don't think we have the problems here that some people in Europe have with the Trump administration. Is that your experience from 18 months here?
Yes, it is.
And why would that be the case?
But hold on, let me expand outward a little bit, because I think you've recognized that, and part of it is simple things like you don't have a trade imbalance with the United States of America, right? Things that President Trump fastens on. Part of it is a recognition that Australia is a very good ally. But there's another part of the equation too, which is if we begin to think about the geopolitical context of a shifting Asia, a rebalancing of power, yes, Australia is doing more. But is it doing enough? That is a question, by the way, as I'm watching keenly on your election, that is fundamentally absent. Now, it's not a popular one, and it's not a promise that you can make, but this is a key question, because if you begin to look at the power dynamics in Asia, they have fundamentally shifted. Yes, Australian spending on defense has gone up slightly, as has Japanese, as has South Korean, but it hasn't matched the other side.
What are we buying?
And there's a question about what you're buying. But there's another question, too, and this is not only about Australia, but this is a broader one, that when powers are reaching into democratic states to influence their own politics, reaching into non-democratic states, I think about Southeast Asia a lot, to reconfigure things, what are we doing to help stabilize, help promote, help defend, and in some ways help to go on to the offensive about democracy? That's a question that is only being answered in the broadest and most abstract terms, that were four values.
Many thanks. We could go on all night, but we have a policy of ending on time.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.